Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on antibiotics when we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this show are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class, and this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. And rule number 1 is don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut and then shut up. Now, if you can learn Rule 1, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And your government is fully capable of making their own case without your help. So don't give the prosecution a victory. Make them at least work for it. Now, listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation and, indeed, in some cases, police intimidation. The first judge, in a case called U.S. v. Dickerson, said this. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? Quite a statement. The second judge, in a case called Belknap v. U.S., said this. He said, you can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. Remember, that's Belknap v. U.S. And the third judge put it this way. He said, the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted in Marchetti v. United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. And it's free. You can't beat that combination. Entertaining, educational, informative, and free, all in the same breath. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. That's the school. That's not free. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. I want you to do it right now before you forget. All right, we've been talking about antibiotics, the mainstay of modern medicine. I think if you took antibiotics away from modern medicine, I think you take about half of modern medicine out of the picture. You know that? I mean, just picture it. You know, all of these ladies, you know, that are taking their kids to the doctor for an ear infection, or they got a sore throat, or they've got this or that or something else. What in the hell are you going to give them after you take their penicillin or their antibiotics away from them? See, I don't think you'd have much left, but there's a bigger story than that. And the story on antibiotics, since it's a crutch, it may be a feeble crutch, but antibiotics have been the mainstay of modern American medicine for at least the last 50 or 75 years. I mean, it is the number one prescribed remedy for everything, from colds and flus and whatever you've got. By golly, it's got to be antibiotics. All right, now, the rise of antibiotic-resistant infections. When penicillin became widely available during the Second World War, it was a medical miracle, rapidly vanquishing the biggest wartime killer, infected wounds. Discovered initially by a French medical student, by the name of Ernst Duchesne in 1896, and then rediscovered by Scottish physician Alexander Fleming in 1928, the product of the soil mold, penicillin, crippled many types of disease-causing bacteria. But just 4 years after drug companies began mass-producing penicillin in 1943, microbes began appearing that could resist penicillin. And the first bug to battle penicillin was Staphylococcus aureus, and this bacterium is often a harmless passenger in the human body. But it can cause illness such as pneumonia or toxic shock syndrome when it overgrows or produces a toxin. In 1967, another type of penicillin-resistant pneumonia caused by Streptococcus pneumonia and called pneumonococcus surfaced in a remote village in Papua New Guinea. At about the same time, American military personnel in Southeast Asia were acquiring penicillin-resistant gonorrhea from prostitutes in Vietnam. By 1976, when the soldiers had come home, they brought the new strain of gonorrhea with them, and physicians had to find new drugs to treat it. In 1983, a hospital-acquired intestinal infection caused by the bacterium Enterococcus faecium joined the list of bugs that outwit penicillin. Antibiotic resistance spreads fast. Between 1979 and 1987, for example, only 0.2% of pneumonococcus strains infecting a large number of patients surveyed by the National Center for Disease Control and Prevention were penicillin resistant. Okay, keep that number in mind, 0.02%. The CDC survey included 13 hospitals in 12 states. Today, 6.6% of pneumonococcus strains are resistant, according to a report in the June 15, 1994 Journal of the American Medical Association by Robert F. Bremen, M.D., and colleagues at the CDC. So it's jumped from 0.02 to 6.6%. Now, the agency also reports that in 1992, 13,300 hospital patients died of bacterial infections that were resistant to antibiotic treatment. All right, now, remember when we began the series, I told you the story about a young Marine who survived his war wounds and then came home to the United States and died from one of these antibiotic resistant strains of bacteria. Now, 13,000, this is back in 92, now this is, you know, pushing 15 years now. 13,000 people go to the hospital. Just picture this, you're going to the hospital to have your appendix removed, or maybe you're going to the hospital to have cosmetic surgery, and you expect to be in, get it done, and leave, and everything's going to be copacetic, you know, with your new breast implants, and you find out that you've got some bug. You go to the doctor, he shoots you up with antibiotics, and then you die from the bug. How do you like that? See, when we go to the hospital, we think that the hospital is about as safe as any place you can go, but as safe as a kid's playground. Come to find out, hospitals are filled with all kinds of bacteria, and many of these bacteria now are resistant to antibiotics, which is the mainstay of American medicine. And indeed, I would suggest that it's probably the mainstay of allopathic medicine worldwide. Now, there was a complacency back in the 1980s, and the perception was that we had licked the bacterial infection problem. Drug companies weren't working on new agents. They were concentrating on other areas such as viral infections, says Michael Blum, MD, medical officer in the Food and Drug Administration's Division of Anti-Infective Drug Products. In the meantime, resistance increased to a number of commonly used antibiotics, possibly related to overuse of antibiotics. Let me underline that. Possibly related to overuse of antibiotics. Well, just think about it. You know, we eat antibiotics in our meat, milk, butter, and eggs every day. Every day. If you're normal. I'm not normal, so I'm not eating it every day, but once in a while. Now, you know, you keep doing that until you develop a body that is antibiotic resistant. Then we introduce one of these superbug pathogens, and then modern medicine says, oh my God, we don't know what to do next. So I've been telling you in this series of programs that what you do next is you concentrate on your immune system. Now, sometimes you're not going to have very much time. Remember the young Marine, by the time his symptoms developed full-blown and he was getting the chills, he had to have emergency medical assistance from that point on. And they worked on him for about a week, and in a week's time, he was dead. So oftentimes, boys and girls, you have to have this right at your fingertips, which is why I'm telling you in advance. You've got to have Dr. Schultz's catalog right in front of you, right then. And then when this happens to you, and you're developing the chills, and you go to the doctor, and he gives you these antibiotics, and the antibiotics don't do anything. All right, you're antibiotic resistant. The one line of defense that you were relying upon, your immune system has failed you. And now your second line of defense, your antibiotics, they have now failed you. Now what are you going to do? You've got five more options, kids. Five more. But you're going to have those five options available to you right now. Right now. You see, by the time you send an order in to Dr. Schultz and you get your order back in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you will have been dead. The funeral will have already been held and you will have been moldering in your grave for 2 weeks by the time your order comes from Schultz out in California. So that's why I'm suggesting to you that you get your act together and you get prepared. Because by the time the Titanic hits the ice, you got 2 hours and 20 minutes. Okay? It's 2 hours and 20 minutes and you're going to be swimming. So then your common sense has to tell you, you got to have this thing scoped out in advance so that when it happens, you're prepared for it. So here at the law school, we have one of these healing oil kits. We already have a supply of colloidal silver. We always keep raw garlic. We have frozen colostrum, and we have many healing herbs. 84. Last time I counted, I was upstairs just the other day, and I was sitting on the toilet, as people are wont to do. Now, normal people, when they sit on the toilet, you know, they're reading a magazine. I was sitting on the toilet counting the herbal remedies in the rack in the bathroom. Where we keep them. Here we keep them in the bathroom. And so they're on there. And I counted them, and there's 84 on the rack. There's more than that, though. I was in a health food store the other day, and they've got bins in there where they carry the herbal remedies, or herbal, the herbs. And I counted 154 holes that had names on them. That would indicate to me that there's at least 154 herbs. We don't have all 154 herbs that I saw in the health food store rack, but I got 84. 84. Which leaves me short by about half. But I bet you I got enough of them in there that I could do something for my immune system, and I could do it right away, which is why I'm pointing this out to you. Now, in the 1990s, we've come to a point for certain infections that we don't have agents available. Now, we're talking about the 1990s here, but in this report was put out 4-8 of 07. This comes from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA homepage table of contents. So I'm getting this right from the horse's mouth. This report comes from www.fda.gov. FDAC/features 795. So I guess you want bulletin number 795 if you want this report right here. 6 pages. Now, these kinds of reports come across my desk. My computer man, Dirk, you know, he sits there at the computer daily searching the world for new topics for me to talk about on the radio. And this topic came up, and he said, oh my God, look at antibiotic resistance. And I said, yeah, what about it? And he said, well, read this. And I did. And I read it, and I said, oh my God. I didn't realize it was getting this bad. 13,000 people back in the 1990s. I don't know what it is today, see? But if 13,000 were dying back in 1992 because of antibiotic-resistant bugs in our hospitals, and it grew from 0.2% to 6.6%, my God, let me see if I can divide this out on my famous Texas Instruments calculator. 0.02 divided by 6.6 is 0.003030. I don't know quite what that means, but it looks like to me I divided it wrong. Let's put 6.6 divided by 0.02, and it looks like it has grown. Yeah, that's what happened there. That's my dyslexic problem there. Yeah, I had it backwards. 330%. Is that right? Or is it 3,330%? In any event, it has grown a whole bunch. And your chances now of getting an antibiotic-resistant strain of bacteria into your body in the hospital that will kill you is a whole lot better today than it was in 1992. Now, it wasn't real big back in 1992, but it's getting bigger, better, and worser already. And I thought I would point that out to you, that just because you go to the hospital to have breast implants put in, ladies, doesn't mean that you're going to come out of there alive. So you want to tuck that one away in your hearts as you go in for your routine cosmetic surgery. Now, the increased prevalence of antibiotic resistance is an outcome of evolution. By God, if there's ever an evolution story, this has got to be it. The increased prevalence of antibiotic resistance is an outcome of evolution. And that's because these bugs are evolving right in front of our eyeballs. Any population of organisms, bacteria included, naturally includes variants with unusual traits. In this case, the ability to withstand an antibiotic's attack on a microbe. When a person takes an antibiotic, the drug kills the defenseless bacteria, leaving behind or selecting, in biological terms, those that can resist it. These renegade bacteria then multiply, increasing their numbers a millionfold in a day, becoming the predominant microorganism. Now let's think about that for a second. You got a million of these bacteria. You take the penicillin and it kills 999,999 of these bacteria, but one of them survives. The one out of a million that is resistant to the penicillin doesn't die. He multiplies. And out of that survivor, we have the new strain of penicillin-resistant bacteria. Works that way with coyotes, too. Out in the West, they used to have a coyote problem. Now, coyotes are primarily, well, they used to be, primarily carrion eaters, kind of like buzzards, you know. They don't go out and kill animals and eat them. They wait until the animal dies, then they run over and they eat it. Well, out in the West, when they go out and they'd find some carcass that some coyote was eating, they said, well, it looks like to us that coyote must have killed that lamb and is over there eating it. So they'd go out and they'd take a lamb carcass and they'd put poison in it. And then the coyote who's eating carrion comes over and he eats that carrion. He eats that dead lamb. And he gets the poison and he dies. Over time, the carrion-eating coyotes were killed off. Now, there always have been a few, not very many, but there always have been a few killer coyotes. Not many, but a few. The killer coyotes don't eat carrion. They eat fresh kill. So, when you poison the dead bodies, you kill off all of the carrion-eating coyotes, which the killer coyotes were breeding with, until you weeded out all of the carrion eaters until all you had left were the killer coyotes. And so now in the West they just have killer coyotes. They don't have carrion eating coyotes. Out here in the East, now we still have the carrion eaters. We have a few killers, but we have mainly carrion eaters. Now if we leave them alone, there will always be a few killers, but you know, you can go out and shoot those. But mainly you got carrion eaters and they're not a problem. Well, now, what we did here was we attacked these bacteria with our antibiotics. And so now we are developing just the killer strains of bacteria. You like that one? Now, the antibiotic does not technically cause the resistance, but it allows the resistance to occur by creating a situation where an already existing variant can flourish. Whenever antibiotics are used, there is selective pressure for resistance to occur. It builds on itself. More and more organisms develop resistance to more and more drugs, says Joe Cranston, Ph.D., director of the Department of Drug Policy and Standards at the American Medical Association in Chicago. Ah, so, you know, if you want to develop antibiotics, that's good. That's good. But you want to use them very, very selectively. I mean, you know, it's kind of like cesarean section. I'm not opposed to cesareans. But, you know, come on, kids. 35% of American women have babies now by cesarean. Is that because the population has now become so weak that we can't have babies naturally now? Or have we gotten to the point over here where we're so damn lazy that we don't want to? I mean, after all, it's called labor. And Are you women out there getting to be so damn lazy you don't want to work at labor, having babies? Now, you know, if everybody starts having these cesareans, you're going to get to a point in time over here when if the cesareans are taken away from you and you have to go back to natural childbirth, that could get real traumatic real fast, couldn't it, girls? Kind of like these coyotes. I mean, you know, you're developing, you are creating these super bugs. There have always been a few super bugs, but they were always outnumbered by the little weak bugs. Now you kill off all the weak ones and all you got left is the strong, virile, killer super bugs. And pretty soon all you're going to have left is the strong, killer super bugs that the penicillin doesn't take care of. Now, will your immune system take care of these new super bugs? The answer is yep, it will. Yeah. Yeah, your immune system can stay on top of those, but you got to have a strong, vibrant, healthy immune system. So I'd suggest that you might consider working on that immune system, number one. Now, disease-causing microbes thwart antibiotics by interfering with their mechanism of action. For example, penicillin kills bacteria by attaching to their cell walls, then destroying a key part of the wall. The wall falls apart and the bacteria dies. Resistant microbes, however, either alter cell walls so penicillin cannot bind or produce enzymes that dismantle the antibiotic. In another scenario, here's a big word here, erythromycin attacks ribosomes, structures within a cell that enable it to make proteins. These resistant bacteria have slightly altered ribosomes, so to which the drug cannot bind. The ribosomal route is also how bacteria become resistant to the antibiotics called tetracycline, streptomycin, and gentamicin. Now, antibiotic resistance results from gene action. Bacteria acquire genes conferring resistance in any of three ways. In spontaneous DNA mutation, bacterial DNA, the genetic material, may mutate or change spontaneously, indicated by a starburst. Drug-resistant tuberculosis arises this way. In a form of microbial sex called transformation, one bacterium may take up DNA from another bacterium. Penicillin-resistant gonorrhea results from this transformation. Most frightening, however, is resistance acquired from a small circle of DNA called a plasmid that can flit from one type of bacterium to another. A single plasmid can provide a slew of different resistances. In 1968, 12,500 people in Guatemala died in an epidemic of Shigella diarrhea. The microbe harbored a plasmid carrying resistance to four antibiotics. It's a vicious cycle, more infections and then antibiotic overuse. Though bacterial antibiotic resistance is a natural phenomenon, societal factors also contribute to the problem. These factors include increased infection transmission coupled with inappropriate antibiotic use. More people are contracting infections. Sinusitis among adults is on the rise, as are ear infections in children. A report by the CDC's Linda F. McQuaig and James M. Hughes, M.D., published in January 1995, the Journal of the American Medical Association, tracks antibiotic use in treating common illnesses. The report cites nearly 6 million antibiotic prescriptions for sinusitis in 1985. Did you get that? 6 million in 85, 13 million in 92. That's double. In 7 years, they doubled. Similarly, for middle ear infections, the numbers are 15 million prescriptions in 85, 23.6 million in 92. Didn't double, but it went up by about 50%. Now, causes for the increase in reported infections are diverse. Some studies correlate the doubling in doctor's office visits for ear infections for preschoolers between 75 and 90 to increased use of daycare facilities. Homelessness attributes to the spread of infection, and ironically, advances in modern medicine have made more people predisposed to infection. People on chemotherapy and transplant recipients taking drugs to suppress their immune function are at greater risk of infection. There are the number of immunocompromised patients who wouldn't have survived in earlier times, says Cranston. Radical procedures produce patients who are in different shape in the hospital and are prone to nosocomial hospital-acquired infections. Also, the general aging of patients who live longer, get sicker, and die slower contributes to the problem, he adds. And though some people clearly need to be treated with antibiotics, many experts are concerned about the inappropriate use of these powerful drugs. Powerful. That's the way my old stepdad used to use the word. Powerful. He was from Pennsylvania. They weren't just powerful drugs, they were powerful. Now, here's the report from, and get this, this comes from the FDA, the FDA, you know, here, if you, boys and girls, if you can't trust your government now, who can you trust? Now, your FDA is telling you these antibiotics are called powerful drugs. Excuse me, boys and girls, but if you've got powerful drugs, why are you taking your little kid into the doctor to have powerful drugs for something like an ear infection? Doesn't strike me that an ear infection is life-threatening. And it would seem like to me, like I reported to you last time, that if you just left the ear infection alone, it would go away all by itself because your immune system will deal with that infection. Now, if it gets real bad and you really need that ace up your sleeve, wouldn't you like to have it still there? Boys and girls, when there's a small pot, you don't need to take the ace out of your sleeve. But when there's a big pot, that's when you need to use the ace. Now, that's just common sense, ain't it? Hey, hang on a second. I got to give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. There's more to come. And the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. GeorgeGordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, except for today's report, which comes from the Food and Drug Administration, which we don't know whether it's true or false. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners, although we are not recommending the FDA to anybody. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not wholly endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And that certainly applies to the FDA. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're back, and I wanted to remind you again of the utter truth about colostrum. Remember, I told you about Herb Doc over here. I'm going to promote these two publications again for you so that you can be prepared, because by the time the superbug attacks you, you might have less than 5 or 6 days. That's where that Marine was. He had about 5 or 6 days. Then it became hopeless, and they just disconnected the life support. If you want to call Herb Doc, you can call 1-800-HERB-DOC if you can figure out that code. It's 1-800-437-2362. And I'm not recommending any of his products, although I think all of his products are good. I'm not recommending any of them. I'll let you decide that for yourself. All I'm suggesting is that you get his catalog so that you have the available products in front of your eyeballs, so that you'll know what you need to have on your shelf, so that in the event that you have this super bug like super gonorrhea or super TB or super duper this or that or something else, every once in a while, you know, somebody goes over to a hamburger stand and they buy a hamburger and they come down with this E. coli. kids, E. coli is in your gut right now. E. coli is as common as pig tracks in a barnyard. It's everywhere. There's a lot of these infections that are killing people today that are just common. You've got them up your nose, for crying out loud. And then they get in the wrong place at the wrong time, and then they develop this antibiotic resistance. You run off to the doctor, he shoots you full of penicillin or some other antibiotic, and it doesn't work, and you die. And I've been reporting to you, I mean, there's 12,000 here. Look, 12,500 people in Guatemala died from diarrhea. Boys and girls, diarrhea is about as common as anything you can get, isn't it? Can you picture dying from the runs? And yet here's 12,500 people in Guatemala died in 1968 because they had Shigella diarrhea. The microbe harbored a plasmid carrying resistance to four antibiotics. So the people were sick, ran to the doctor shot them up with antibiotics, and then they died. Now, of course, there were probably thousands of other people that got shots and of penicillin or whatever, and they didn't die. Now, these 12,500 people, had they known about colostrum? Colostrum. Healing oils of the Bible, raw garlic, healing herbs, or strengthening their immune system, probably could have survived that. Hell, I've had the runs, you know, two or three times in my lifetime, haven't you? I can't quite picture dying from diarrhea, but you know it happens. So here at the law school, we have, in addition to antibiotics, we have the healing oils of the Bible, colloidal silver, raw garlic, colostrum, healing herbs. And when we get the runs over here, we say, ooh, we got the runs. This could, probably won't, but it could be life-threatening. Why don't we do something about those bad bugs right now with some colloidal silver? And then we just headed off at the pass, and then it never happens, and then we live happily ever after, and it's just a little footnote to history. You know, George Gordon had diarrhea, and he recovered from it without any further ill effects. Okay? And that's the way you would like your diseases to come out. We don't want to hear that you died from some bacteria after you survived your war wounds, do we? God, that was a tragedy. I just can't get over, you know, some young man dying from a crummy bug because the doctors over here didn't have the antibiotics that they needed to save his life. But there were six other solutions to the problem, and the medicos didn't know anything about it. And I want to tell you about the utter truth about colostrum, written by William E. Frazier. Cost $10. I don't know where you're going to get it. Let me give you his address. I guess I'll take that back. I guess you could write to this guy and probably get it from him. They don't have a publisher in here. Maybe he's published this by himself. That can be done, you know. Maybe he's self-published. William Frazier, P.O. Box 1550, Lake City, Florida, 32056. P.O. Box 1550, Lake City, Florida, 32056. I would suggest that you send him $13. $10 for the book, because that's what's marked on here, $10. And it's the best book I've ever seen on colostrum. I read a lot of books, kids. And it's just 100 pages. It's nothing to brag about, you know. Nothing big. You can probably read this thing in a day. Most of you people probably could. It takes me about a week. I only read 237 words a minute. Evelyn Woods said, even for $1,200, we can't help you, Mr. Gordon. I went to the Evelyn Woods Reading Dynamics course. They said they could help my wife for the $1,200. They could help her. But they said, Mr. Gordon, for you, there's no help. So there I am. There I am reading. I'm so slow at reading, I have to read from the back of the book to the front. I've got to read the final chapter and get the answer before I read the first chapter and find out what the hell the problem is. Otherwise, I'd never get the damn job done. So that's the way I read, from the back of the book to the front. Sometimes I only read three or four chapters in the book. I got a daughter over here. She picks up a book, she reads the whole thing in one day. big books, you know, 300, 400, 500, 600 pages. How in the hell can you read 600 pages in one day? I can't even turn 600 pages in one day. My arthritis is too bad. Well, if I tried to turn 600 pages in one day, I probably wouldn't be able to recuperate in a week. I got a girl upstairs. She sits down. She reads a book. Of course, she doesn't sleep. I go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, and then I wake up in the morning, and she's there. But, you know, I don't know when she came to bed. That's because I sleep at night. My wife reads at night. Other people, normal people, like you, could probably read this 100 pages. In an hour or two, it takes me about a week, but I read it, and it's well worth the $10. Because now I'm going to put this little book up here on my shelf, because now it tells me when I've got a question about colostrum, what does it do, what doesn't it do, why does it do it, how does it work, and why, and where do you buy it, and how do you get it, and how do you use it, and how do you take it, and all the hows and what ifs and buts is in this little book on everything you ever wanted to know about colostrum. It's called The Utter Truth About Colostrum. That's spelled UDDER. All right. Now, there's those two. So if you die from some bacteria, from super gonorrhea to AIDS to... Now, AIDS, I'll take that one back. That AIDS is a little trickier to cure. But it's curable. And Dr. Schultz over here has what he's called the incurables. When you've got diabetes and you've had it for 30 years, he puts you on the incurables program. And you can cure it. I just wanted to tell you that ahead of time. I know it sounds preposterous and it can't be done, and you've talked to 15 doctors. Listen, you know, you could talk to 300 doctors and they'll all tell you the same thing. Cancer is incurable. That's the official party line. There's 10 cures to cancer. 10. 10. Got that? And for everything else, there's 6. Well, if you want to throw antibiotics in, there'd be 7. Now, antibiotics work. I'm not telling you that they don't work and that you shouldn't go to your doctor and get shot up with penicillin. I'm telling you, when the penicillin don't work, now what are you going to do? And the young Marine died. So I'm sitting there saying, okay, you don't have to go to healing oils of the Bible, colloidal silver, raw garlic, colostrum, or healing herbs, or even your own immune system first. You can go to the doctor first. You can go to the antibiotics first. You can do everything until there's nothing left in the arsenal of medical science and you're faced with death. Then go to something that works and save your life. How's that for a plan? Do everything else first, and then when it doesn't work, then go to something that does work. Now, though bacterial antibiotic resistance is a natural phenomenon, societal factors also contribute to the problem. These factors include increased infection transmission coupled with inappropriate antibiotic use. I had to read that to you a second time because I wanted to emphasize that point. Boys and girls, the routine shooting up of animals or the feeding of antibiotics to our animals routinely in their daily rations put out by Ralston Purina, for instance, is one of those inappropriate antibiotic uses. Taking your kid to the doctor, the pediatrician, to have him shot up with antibiotics because he's whining and crying and his nose is running because you've been feeding him sugar and Kool-Aid and all the rest of the crap is a natural process that you ought to let run its course so that you don't overuse the antibiotic. Someday you may actually need it. So I just thought I'd throw that out. These are called powerful drugs by the Food and Drug Administration. Don't you think that something that's a powerful drug ought to be used sparingly? And maybe you could use a weaker drug rather than a powerful drug. You know, use something a little weaker. Now, another much publicized concern is the use of antibiotics in livestock where the drugs are used in well animals, not sick animals, but well animals, to prevent disease. And the animals are later slaughtered for food. If an animal gets a bacterial infection, growth is slowed and it doesn't put on weight as fast, says Joe Madden, Ph.D., strategic manager of microbiology at the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. Boy, that's a mouthful. This guy's a Ph.D., too, which means piled higher and deeper. Piled higher and deeper. That's a Ph.D. In addition, antibiotics are sometimes administered at low levels in feed for long durations to increase the rate of weight gain and to improve the efficiency of converting animal feed to units of animal production. In other words, for every pound of food that you put into the animal, you get more weight gain from it by putting antibiotics in it. It has nothing to do with health, safety, or welfare of you or the animal. It has to do with making more profit. And your food isn't being produced by Amos McFadden down here on his local farm. It's being produced in some big multinational corporate hog farm or feeding operation that's feeding 100,000 steers on a feeding operation, or has 10,000 sows in a pig operation. These are big industrial type feeding operations, and they do it routinely. That's why I stay away from those kinds of food. If it says FDA approved, or if it said USDA approved, or something like that, I avoid it. I stay as far away from that crap as I can get. Killed a steer here the other day in totally bad conditions. How do they word that? You know, in totally unacceptable conditions. I took this steer over under a tree and I shot him between the eyes and I strung him up under a big limb and I gutted him out right there amidst all the flies buzzing around and crawling across the carcass. And there isn't a piece of that meat that's USDA approved. That's what I eat. That's what I eat. And the good clean stuff, you know, that comes from the Swift factory, you know, where they got all these Mexicans cutting up all these animals that have tumors in them. And where they got a hide coming out to shoot every 45 seconds. And the cow goes in one end and the truck drives off with a box of beef on the other end. I don't buy anything out of there. And that's all USDA approved. Okay. Now, that's just me. If you want to eat that stuff, you get right after it. But you want to remember that there's a lot of antibiotics in that meat. And that's a powerful drug. And the Food and Drug. And that's what I'm reading to you right here. This article here comes from www.fda.gov. Boys and girls, if you can't trust your government, I ask, who can you trust? A study conducted by Elaine Cometa, M.D., and his, Elaine, A-L-A-I-N, nothing personal here, Mr. Cometa, but if I had a name like that, I think I'd change it. A-L-A-I-N, I probably can't pronounce it correctly. His name is probably okay, it probably means can't read. But then, a study conducted by A-L-A-I-N, Elaine Cometa, M.D., and his colleagues at the Center Hospital, oh my God, I think it's the Center Hospital at the University of Lucerne, Switzerland. That's why I'm having a problem. This guy's a foreigner. And reported in the April 28th, 1994, New England Journal of Medicine. Not to say that this man doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, when you got a name like that and you come from a place like that, you got to know something. Probably smarter than I am. Anyway, he showed that increase in antibiotic resistance parallels increase in antibiotic use in humans. Now, did you catch that? The more meat you eat with antibiotics in it, the more resistant you're going to be to antibiotics. Put another way, stay away from antibiotics until you really need them, is what they're trying to tell us. They examined a large group of cancer patients given antibiotics called fluoroquinolones to prevent infection. The patients white blood cell counts were very low as a result of their cancer treatment, leaving them open to infection. Between 1983 and 93, the percentage of such patients receiving antibiotics rose from 1.4 to 45. The percentage from 1 to 45%. During those years, the researchers isolated Escherichia coli bacteria annually from the patients and tested the microbes for resistance to five types of fluoroquinolones between 1983 and 1990. All 92 E. coli strains tested were easily killed by the antibiotics. But from 1991 to 93, 11 of 40 tested strains, 28%, were resistant to all five drugs. Now pause here for a moment and I'm going to repeat this. Because you don't catch things the first time around. That's what I always object to. I'm listening to the news, and then and about halfway through the article, there's something comes up that's really interesting. And I say, well, where did that come from again? All right, so let me tell you where this comes from. It comes from a guy by the name of Alain, A-L-A-I-N, Cometa, M-D. This guy's a medical doctor, and he comes from Switzerland. Whether we can pronounce his name or not is irrelevant. He comes from Switzerland, and he reported in 1994 in the New England Journal of Medicine, and he showed that the increase in antibiotic resistance parallels the increase in antibiotic use in humans. So ladies, when you take your kid into the doctor and have him shot up with this powerful antibiotic drug, powerful drug, because he's got a crummy ear infection, you're doing the kid a big disservice. That's what he's telling you. You ought to protect your kid from having ear infections in the first place. Because now you keep taking the kid into the doctor, and you keep taking him back, and taking him back, and taking him back. By the time this kid's 12, 15 years old, he's so resistant to antibiotics, now something really serious comes up. He goes into the Marines, for crying out loud. He goes over to Iraq. He gets this super bug. He comes back, and he is so resistant to antibiotics that nothing works. So not only is the kid antibiotic resistant, the damn bugs are antibiotic resistant. And I've already told you, I said, hell, half of medicine is antibiotics. If you took antibiotics away from the doctor, he'd go nuts. He wouldn't know what the hell to do next. So let's all wake up and start recognizing that if you want to use antibiotics, they got to be used judiciously, as they say in court. Judiciously. Carefully. Between 1983, now get this now, between 83 and 93, just picture this back about 20 years ago, the percentage of such patients receiving these antibiotics, they tested this on cancer patients over in Lucerne, Switzerland. They got a bunch of cancer patients in there. Their resistance, their immune systems are working at a very low level. And they get infections. Now remember, your primary defense against disease and death is your own immune system. You want to be building your immune system, kids, with colostrum and herbs and colloidal silver and healing oils of the Bible. You want to be building your immune system. You want to have an immune system that works at 90, 95, 98, 99% of efficiency all the time so that you don't get sick in the first place. But if for some reason your immune system drops off and you get sick, you got to have something to come in there and take its place. And so normal people, they rely upon antibiotics. And so they tested these cancer patients with low immune resistance. During those years, the researchers isolated this particular Escherichia coli bacteria annually from the patients and tested the microbes for resistance to five types of the fluoroquinolones. Between 83 and 90, all 92 E. coli strains tested were easily killed by these antibiotics. Easily killed. I mean, you know, they got cancer patients. The E. coli attacks the cancer patient. They shoot the cancer patient up with the antibiotic, kills the bug, saves the patient's life, which is the design of the drug and the purpose for the whole program. Works like a shot.
Okay. But here's what happened. From 91 to 93, 11 of the 40 tested strains, that's 28% now, were resistant to all five drugs. These bacteria become resistant to these antibiotics. They have to be used slowly, judiciously, over a long period of time, carefully. They're powerful drugs. Don't use them indiscriminately. That's the point of the man's story. Now, antibiotic resistance is inevitable, say scientists, but there are measures that we can take to slow it. Efforts are underway on several fronts, improving infection control, developing new antibiotics, and using drugs more appropriately. I'm going to underline using drugs more appropriately. It's kind of like having childbirth, you know. There may come a time when you need to have a cesarean, but ladies, it ought to be used very, very rarely. You know, I had a wife one time. We had five children together, five babies. And they all came out the normal way. But I went to the hospital one day. She was having a baby. And had this doctor, he caught me on the elevator. You know, as the elevator doors open, and I looked out, and this stepping out of the elevator, here's this guy with his stethoscope and with his white coat. And he said, "Mr. Gordon?" Evidently, they called him from downstairs and said Gordon's on his way up. And so, and he said, "Oh, Mr. Gordon, your wife is having problems with this birth, and we need to perform a cesarean." He had the papers right in his hand. He handed them to me, thrust them in my face. And he said, "We must proceed immediately. This is a life-threatening circumstance." I thought, what? Now, my wife has already had four babies. They just fall out of her. Her problem wasn't in having them. Her problem was in keeping them in her. And so when this doc said he had to have a cesarean, right away, my super Gordon suspicious antennae extended and started probing around, like, what the hell is this guy talking about? So I said, "What seems to be the problem?" So he said, "Well, you know, your wife is having a problem having this child." And I said, "Well, let's go talk to her." And he said, "Oh, we can't. She's under sedation." He wants me to sign the papers so that he can go in and operate, take this baby by cesarean. I said, "If you do that without my consent..." He said, "We don't need your consent. We can do this in an emergency." I said, "Well, if this is an emergency, then you don't need me to sign. You just get in there and get after it, son. But rest assured that if there's any problems that develop from this, litigation will surely follow." And a miracle happened. My wife woke up, had the baby, and there wasn't a need for a cesarean. I suspected thereafter that the doctor had a boat or airplane payment due and he needed a little extra money, which at that time paid $5,000. Tuck it away in your heart, boys and girls, that not every medical opinion is necessarily correct. That's why you need a second opinion. And before you go signing the papers, why don't you ask your wife first whether she wants one of those cesareans? She might not. Hey, I'm out of time again, kids. I'm going to leave it right there. So let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about the Law School and or the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.